Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Achieve clean, healthy-looking skin with Youth to the People. The 20-time award-winning superfood cleanser gently deep cleanses and removes makeup and SPF in 30 seconds for skin that's hydrated, balanced, and soothed, never stripped. It's the green juice cleanse for your face, formulated with good-for-you antioxidants like kale, spinach, and multivitamins to respect your barrier. No disruption. Find out why one cleanser is sold every minute in the U.S. Shop now at Sephora.
Welcome to another episode of Heretics. Today on the podcast, I've got one of my favourite people in the world. I'm very excited to put this one out into the world. It's Will Storr. Will Storr is a wonderful writer. He's a hero of mine. He's one of the people who really influenced me indirectly because he didn't know who I was, and nor should he, when I was reading his books, but they were a huge influence on me. And we're really discussing the status game today, which just has influenced my thinking so much. I know that many of you are probably tired of hearing about it, of course. He also wrote a book aptly named The Heretics, where he goes around talking to all different kinds of people who believe very different things. We're talking about creationists and things like that. He wrote Selfie, How the West Became Self-Obsessed, and The Science of Storytelling. So some really, really interesting books. One of the interesting things that he told me is that Selfie did extremely well with so many mainstream publishers and legacy media because Selfie was about the West becoming self-obsessed. It was derogatory about the West and was a critique on the individualism that became quite extreme among us, but while also looking at the good sides of that, because I quite like individualism. The status game, however, just was sort of ignored a little bit by the mainstream, whereas podcasters and alternative media and influencers absolutely loved it. Will appeared on Joe Rogan to talk about it, all sorts of huge podcasts, because it seemed to be explaining a lot to us about three main types of gaining status and why status is so important to each of us as individuals, and what sort of games we play with one another to gain status over the tribe or over the rest of the tribe, or just to become good at stuff and be respected for things. So dominance, success, and virtue. So we talk about all of those, and I think one of the reasons a lot of the mainstream media ignored it was because the virtue aspect of status seemed to explain a lot of perhaps celebrities and other mainstream people and their behavior in trying to look like they are good and virtuous. It's just as selfish as anything dominant or looking for success or any kind of gain of status or pursuit of status. So I hope you guys will enjoy this, and I really hope you will look up Will's brilliant book, The Status Game, that you can try and get hold of it and buy it and read it, because he is absolutely wonderful. I'm a huge fan, so please do support my guest and enjoy this episode. How might The Status Game explain some aspects of woke culture?
Woke culture? Wow, we're going straight in there.
Bam.
Well, I mean, I think the bigger picture to start off with is that the pursuit of status is a human fundamental. Everybody, every human being alive is simultaneously pursuing connection with other people. We want to feel like a sense of belonging, but we also want to feel valued by other people. So we're always seeking the respect. So I think of it as we want to be connected and respected. And if you're connected and respected by the people around you, you're generally psychologically healthy. You know, lots of people suffering depression either feel unloved or that they have no value in the world. So connection is a massive thing. Status is also a massive thing. And there are obviously, but pursuing status, pursuing the sense that we are a valuable person, is difficult. And there are kind of various routes to status. One is dominance. We can just like push each other around and kind of force them to attend to us in status. That's kind of an animalistic, old-fashioned way. But humans also have the other two routes to status. One of them is competence or success. So we can be we can work hard and become really good at something. That's quite difficult. But the other route is virtue. So one way that humans can be can earn status is by developing the reputation of a virtuous person. So that can be a selfless person, a courageous person, a kind person. But it can also be a person who is very into the kind of moral sphere, the moral rules of the world. They've got their own very rigid set of rules about how the world should be morally, and they enforce those rules to other people. So I think that's the kind of those are the kind of psychological underpinnings of wokeness. Mm. Underneath it all is this kind of relentless pursuit of virtue-based status, especially in the kind of social media sphere, because that's where this stuff is harvested a lot.
Interesting. Yeah, I just in my book I was just writing about politeness, which is a nice idea, politeness, but I think sometimes it can mean just adherence to societal norms.
Yeah,
and with secrets, for example, it's the last person you would tell a secret to is a polite person, because they're in the Stasi, or a polite Nazi,
yes,
going to dob you in.
Yeah.
So what I was going to ask actually was of dominance, success, and virtue.
Yeah.
Virtue has to be the most interesting, do you think?
No, I think success. It depends on interesting. I think success. I think one of the big ways that the status game research changed the way I see the world is exactly that. Whereas I suppose as a kind of temperamentally left wing person, I just assumed that if you want to do good in the world, then pursue virtue. Of course, be kind. But that's actually not true. If you look at the history, especially the last 200 or 300 years of the human world, it's people who pursue success who do good in the world. So somebody who will be trying to figure out how to create a vaccine is playing a success game.
Yeah.
And, the people who've created the vaccines have done more good in the world than all the popes and imams put together, as far as I'm concerned. That's how you do good in the world. You pursue success. That's how you change lives for the better. So that to me is the more interesting route. It's also the more difficult route, but it's also the most sort of impressive route. I mean, there's something just hugely impressive about seeing somebody that is at the top of their game, like an amazing chef, an amazing stand-up comic. Like, it's amazing experiencing what they do, but just seeing that level of insane competence is kind of like a weird kind of pornography. Like, it's amazing to see. So that to me is the most interesting. The virtue-based status, once you see it for what it is, it kind of becomes the most depressing, because it's a lot. It's so circular. It's just every status game has its own particular norms, its own rules of what it believes is right and wrong. They're often local. They're often weird, it's just people going around in circles enforcing these rules in other people. So it's kind of, you have to ask what good is that doing the world? What good is that doing anyone but themselves?
Is there a sense of people are trying to be successful, but some can't, right? Not everybody can be the most successful person in the tribe.
Yeah.
And do they then often lean towards one of either being a bit of a bully, dominance, or virtue, which is showing everyone how wonderful and nice they are?
Well, I think one of the important things to know about status is that it isn't about being the best. It's just about being respected by other people. So it's not that we have to be the best chef in the world or even the best chef in the restaurant, but you have to be, it's just that feeling of like, I'm pretty good at this.
Yeah.
That's all it is. And it's important that other people reflect that back at us too. Like, other people kind of give us the gift of prestige, that kind of form of status. So it's not that we all have to be the best or even want to be the best. Actually, when you ask most people don't want to be at the very top, because at the very top comes all this pressure and responsibility, and it's really the kind of alpha A players that pursue that kind of peak performance. Most people aren't that insane.
Yeah.
But there is some truth in what you say, and I think a lot of that you can see culturally over the last maybe 20 years. My kind of theory about one of the things that's responsible for the rise of woke culture is that, I'm a Gen Xer, so I was raised in the 80s, 90s, and early noughties, which were this kind of peak, the peak era of the success game kind of culture, where success was what was valued, most of all, especially beginning in the 80s. And so success games were kind of really defined Western culture in a major way. And I think that certainly the perception and definitely a lot of the reality is that for millennials and Gen Z people, those success games have become much harder because the economic, especially since the financial crisis, the economic sphere has become much tougher. Hmm. So there's the perception, and you know, the perception is what matters, not the reality. People think that the game is fixed. People think that there's no point pursuing success because I'm not going to get this. I've got this huge student debt. I'm not going to get on the property ladder. It's all fixed by these straight white men who are just ruling the world unfairly. And so what do you do if you can't source your status in the world of success? You move to virtue, because that's another reliable way of earning status. And I think that's part of the reason why we've seen particularly young people move into, because there is such a generational divide. It's primarily Gen Z and millennial people, as far as I can see, who've moved into this kind of very kind of angry, aggressive, virtue-based status play that is wokeism.
I suppose, because what else can you do at that age? Because I remember being a student and I would go on like dates with girls.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking back now, like, what the hell did I talk about when I was 18 on a date? Like, yeah. What did I say? Like, I'm apart from my mum does this and that. Or like, my teacher at school is such a difficult, you know, how do you, yeah. And then you see, I guess we were all putting like the same posters up to show how individual we were in dorms, you know, everybody had that one of train spotting. Choose this, choose that. Goodfellas and Pulp Fiction. And it's like, look how individual I am. This is who I am. I'm this different, maybe successful, interesting person. And I suppose at that age, it is a difficult time to express any kind of success because you haven't had it yet.
Yeah.
But by being virtuous, you're able to join a cause and fight. Is that it?
We're always playing status games and they're kind of groupish. So that's right, that we all seek to join these groups because the group defines what is high status behavior, what kind of behavior and beliefs are going to earn you status and what kind of beliefs and behavior are going to remove status from you. And so that's why it's a game. There are these rules and depending on how well we play by the rules, we kind of rise or fall in status. And that's true of all human groups, whether it's religion, a cult, a business, you know, whatever it is, that status game stuff is always going on.
You speak of growing up in sort of the success times when success was most valued as a status game. But I suppose there was also a bit more dominance, wasn't it? I suppose I feel like the movie stars of the time would show off about like if they've slept with lots of women and if they're quite, you know, big and boisterous. And so that's moved away, has it, maybe?
Well, I'm not sure that sexual success is dominance.
Okay.
I mean, I think that's a kind of separate, I would think, I mean, not all of status play is dominance, virtue, and success. Things like being good looking is none of those things. Age has status things attached to it. It's not really attached to anything. And I think sexual success probably isn't either. It's this, I mean, if anything, it's, is it competence? I don't know. If you're playing the game of the, picture with the pickup artist, those people, that's like a weird kind of competence-based success game where you're measuring your status by how successful you are at having sex with people.
But I think of the casting rooms, the Harvey Weinsteins, like dominance was, does it feel more enabled back in the day, more allowed?
I don't think so, because dominance is really about coercion. Hmm. A dominance game would be the army. It would be a boxing doing boxing. So when you're literally forcing people to attend to you in status, that's dominance. Like if you think about it in the animal realm, when two chickens are pecking at each other to establish a pecking order, that's dominance. Yeah, I don't think it really has anything to do with sex, unless you're, of course, you know, you're forcing somebody to, you know, like in a Harvey Weinstein situation. That's, of course, I don't think even that's about status. That's just about being a
monster.
Yeah, being a monster, yeah.
We can say it, he's in prison. Yeah, he won't come and get us, hopefully. Yeah. Okay, oh shit, I lost my train of thought, I had it. Yeah. One of the things I've been trying to think about when addressing woke culture, I think people are often surprised, I have to tell them about this YouTube channel I've got, and they're like, oh, but you, I think they think of me as quite mild-mannered, maybe. Mm. And you're also quite mild-mannered, and we've written books, we're sort of bookish, I suppose. Mm. Is it important with regards to status, for other people to see people like us talking about this rather than what they might imagine, which is like a big, horrible Nick Griffin, who Americans won't know who Nick Griffin is, but, or even Trump, who's just so not very statesmanlike.
I mean, maybe. I don't think it's going to make an awful lot of difference, to be honest. You know, like if people want to attack us for not signing up to the latest status game that's out there in the, you know, very much in the, in the arts, which is the games that we play, writing books and in the media, then they're going to. I mean, I know you've suffered a bit of that and you know, so it's just going to happen. I don't think they care very much whether we look like Joe Rogan or Nick Griffin or one of these people.
To what extent is cancel culture then actually happening in sort of the book world, publishing, the arts, media? Because I know people are hearing.
I think how wokeness manifests in the publishing industry is various ways. I mean, one of the ways, of course, is in who is there's a limited space in things like book reviews pages, literary festivals, and with the heavy emphasis on diversity, there's a much greater interest in populating those spaces in the politically correct way. Can't have too many straight white men, for example. That's sort of a cancer to these kinds of people. Yeah. So there's a sense that the level of meritocracy isn't there anymore. It has diminished. So that's one way. I mean, there's another way in things like the rise of what do you call them? The readers. The sensitivity readers.
Oh my gosh! Yeah.
Yeah. So that happens. I mean,
what are they?
Well, sensitivity readers are woke people. They're like a woke agency that sells their services to publishing companies, and they will go through someone's manuscript and highlight and sort of erase anything that might trigger the most delicate, politically kind of active flower that you can possibly imagine. I have a friend who I won't name who told me that his book was sensitivity read. And there was a line in it where he was talking, he said he felt like a refugee from his own marriage. That's just a metaphor. He told he couldn't use the word refugee because you might upset people. So it's sort of creative cancer, really. It's just ridiculous. But it's taken extremely seriously by a lot of the cultural gatekeepers these days. So you just have to manage it and negotiate it as best you can. And you just have to kind of swallow it, really. There's not much you can do about it.
It's funny that because there probably aren't many refugees who would be offended.
I know. Yes,
it's on behalf of them, isn't it?
It's on behalf of them, and it's like these things where I think I wrote about it in the Status Game, where if you ask Japanese people if they're offended when white people wear a kimono, they go no. It's like 2% of Japanese people care, give a shit if a white person wears a kimono. They don't care. Yeah. But all these wokey people get very offended if a white person wears a kimono. But the Japanese people themselves don't care. It's like the Latinx thing, you know, like lots of Americans call Latinos or Latinas Latinx. But the actual people from Latin America hate, you know, in general, hate the phrase Latinx, but they get called it anyway. Yeah. So it's this. It's this intense hypocrisy and I think that's part of the place where it reveals it as itself as a status game. They don't actually care about what the Japanese people feel or what the people in Latin America feel. It's all about these are my criteria for claiming status. These are the rules by which high status people and acceptable people have to live by. And if you don't live by them, I'm going to fuck you up and make sure that you, you know, adhere to what I'm saying. And that's why in the book it's like it's a virtue game, but it's also a dominance game, and it's the, you know, a lot of these games kind of blend. And I think the most toxic games of all are virtue dominance games which is to say these people are harvesting status, manufacturing status by being virtuous, but they're using the tactics of dominance and in that way they're operating in the same way as a cult or as in a harmful ideology like Nazism or communism, where people are being forced into adhering to their particular local sets of kind of sacred beliefs.
I see away luggage a lot when I travel. As much as I love its looks, I prefer soft side suitcases and always wished Away made one. Well, guess what? Now they do. This suitcase seriously looks better than any old school soft side suitcases I've seen, and is designed to be lighter than others on the market. Soft side comes in 4 of their best selling sizes and tried and true colours. There is something for everyone in the lineup, 2 carry on sizes, 2 checked sizes, 4 colours, black, blue, pink, grey. Made from a high strength nylon, the bag is tear resistant as well as weather resistant. I spilled a little bit of coffee on the grey one this morning and can confirm the claim holds up. The bag is soft but not sensitive, super durable, flexible and expandable. Bonus points for the compression pad system that helps you pack it in and the anti-tipping stabilizer that holds the bag steady while expanded, both of which are proprietary to Away. And that's actually my favorite bit. It doesn't sort of wobble this way and that. I absolutely pack mine full, take it everywhere I go. Well, when I'm going on holiday, that is. And no matter what's packed inside, it doesn't seem to tip. You've got to check out the new soft side luggage from Away. Head on over to awaytravel.com/heretics. That's awaytravel.com/heretics to see the new soft side luggage from Away. awaytravel.com/heretics.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Well, as I was telling you off screen, and I haven't spoken about it properly, and I'm sort of not at liberty to really, yeah. But you know, what can you do? You can't just be gagged all the time. You've got to live your life and enjoy conversations. That, you know, I'm in the state right now of day after day being disinvited to things.
Yeah.
They can't really believe that if I turned up, it would cause some sort of irreparable damage to their brand, can they? Or do they?
But I think it's more of a personal fear. It's like, it's like, I think one of the really, and this isn't exclusive to kind of wokeism. You see it in communism, in Nazism too, and cult behavior, where association with bad people makes you, you know, risks contaminating you. You know, status leaks is part of the reason why people want to be around high status people and want to not be around low status people. If somebody has been kind of declared kind of haram by the
cancelled for using
that. Yeah, by the high status people in the culture, then nobody wants to go near that person. So and I think it's this kind of cowardly selfishness whereby, well, this person has interviewed this person has spoken to this person has been was once friends with this person once retweeted God. This person, so therefore I can have nothing to do with them. I mean, it really is, it's completely contemptible as far as I'm concerned.
Because, cowardly as well,
because it comes out of cowardliness, and it's fear of my own status being negatively impacted by this person's association with this other person. I mean,
would that explain, the combination of status? And it's important you say that, because I always forget when I go around quoting you to everyone in the world, like an evangelist, a real story evangelist, that people mix the games and it's very nuanced. And I'm just like, well, he's going for the virtue one, he's going for dominant, but it's all a big mix. Would that explain why the very bookshops that don't want me in their bookshop have got loads of Jordan Peterson, loads of Piers Morgan's books, if he has any, they definitely would, Jeremy Clarkson, who are people who have said far, far, far more controversial things than I would ever say. Yeah. Jeremy Clarkson's punched people.
I
wouldn't even know how. Yeah. But is it that they've got a different kind of status that their lack of wokeness or whatever doesn't matter?
Well, they've got they make bank for the bookshops.
Yeah.
I mean that's the sheer hypocrisy of this stuff. An author like Jordan Peterson will find a home at a publishing company that is probably populated with plenty of woke people. But that's okay, because he sells literally millions of books. You know, Piers Morgan and Jeremy Clarkson make massive bank for people. J.K. Rowling makes massive bank for people. Mind you, she, you know, but she's still in all the bookshops, isn't she? But until you're making major money for people, it's going to be, I guess, unfairly pinned on your shoulder. You're going to suffer a little bit more than those other more successful people, unfortunately.
So it is so cowardly, isn't it? It's so selfish. And you're right, as soon as they're making loads of money, and even then you can imagine them in the bookshop sniffing at the Jordan Petersons going, oh gosh, yes. Buy your book, horrible person. the masses, disgusting.
Yeah.
It's incredible how much, these people don't seem to have studied history. Mm. They don't seem to have studied what happens when cults start to say don't associate with these people and so on. How does that start to happen? I mean, historically, I mean, the Stasi, the Bolsheviks, how did that start to happen?
Well, I mean, it's I don't know how it starts to happen, but it's very much about as I say, this sense of contamination, status leaks, the status of the people that we associate with rubs off on us. I mean, that's how celebrity endorsements end up selling massive amounts of trainers or, you know, barbecues, whatever, yeah. whatever it might be, because status leaks. And in the same way, low status leaks. So that's why, you know, people don't want to be associated with people who are low status. And it, you know, if you're in that world and associating with people who are seen as bigoted in any way, even if that's a completely unfair accusation, as it very often is from these people, then that's enough to cast kind of doubt upon your character.
I think the Soviet Union is a really extraordinary example, just because I think of like the Tsar, who was presumably just dominance, instantly replaced by the opposite, which was like this virtue. We're all this virtuous people. Amazing that shift.
Well, I mean that's I mean it's interesting because we see, you know, wokeness is this kind of very faint echo of the same thing, and I think it thinks of itself as this social justice movement because it's wanting for everything to be fairer, but what it's actually just doing is subverting the existing hierarchy. So what happened in the Soviet Union, of course, you had the Tsar at the top and all the workers and the peasants, and they just flipped it. So the workers were at the top, and then there was the peasants, and then the former bourgeoisie were at the bottom, and they were tortured and killed and discriminated against. And, you know, in the Soviet Union, the occupation of your parents was on your passport, you know. So this idea that it was going to be this hierarchy-free utopia of, you know, non-status pursuit is absolute nonsense. It was just a inverted status.
They're doing that at the BBC. Game. When you work for the BBC, you have to say what your parents do, professions.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. It's amazing how this stuff repeats in history. And of course, that's what wokeism is doing. It's saying, well, all these straight white men are at the top, and we're going to put them at the bottom, and we're going to rearrange. So it's not that they want this kind of new world of fairness. They just want a different status game with their own people at the top. I mean,
I suppose some of it comes from a failure to accept that complete fairness is never going to happen.
Yeah. Well, and nor should it. I mean, in the sense that you can't have a human society where everybody is the same, because we're not the same. We have different talents, we have different abilities. And it's only fair that somebody that adds more value to the human world gets more rewards and moves up that status game. I mean, meritocracy is an incredible idea. It's a Western idea. It's the best idea that Western culture has ever come up with. This idea that what matters is not your gender, not your skin color, not your religion. What matters is your competence. You know, what matters is the success game. You know, that's a Western idea, and it's what made the West so incredibly successful, much more than anything else, you know. So certainly over the last sort of couple of hundred years since the Industrial Revolution and the Enlightenment, it's lifted the world, that idea of forget, you know, because before the Industrial Revolution and before the Enlightenment, it was all virtue games everywhere. It was about caste, it was about religion, it was lords and peasants, and we blew that up in the West, and we changed the history of the world in amazing ways. I mean, the whole world the standard of living has gone up immeasurably around the world because of this great Western idea. And it's fundamentally about meritocracy. It's about you're rewarded by how much value you offer to the human family. And I think that's an incredible idea, and this idea that everyone should be earning the same and be the same in every way is a totalitarian evil idea, and it, you know, it's doomed to failure as well, because inevitably some people are always going to be a bit more pushy, a bit more ambitious, a bit more hardworking.
There are some aspects of the woke argument to this that I sympathize with, and I'm sure you do as well, that the starting line is not the same.
Yeah, of course.
And so that's a really hard thing to reconcile with.
Yeah. You know,
what do we do about that? And that's where ideas towards communism and socialism start to creep in.
Yeah.
It's not perfect.
No, of course. I would never argue that we have a perfect meritocracy. Of course, there is such a thing as discrimination. But to that, I would say that this whole idea of meritocracy is really new. And we haven't achieved, you know, we're nowhere near the end game yet. We're still working on this stuff. And through all of my life, there's been an intense interest in fairness for women, fairness for minorities, fairness for gay people. It's been, you know, perhaps even the dominant cultural interest of British culture, you know, all through the 80s, you know, apartheid, the phrase male chauvinist pig, you know, like in the West, we are intensely interested in fairness because we're Westerners, because we're meritocrats. And so of course I agree that the starting line isn't fair, but I would just say that we know that in the West, and we're working on it. We're doing everything we can almost, you know, to kind of figure that out without breaking apart this other idea, which is, you know, meritocracy.
It's really, there's one aspect that I can't even find an answer for, and I'm not sure there is one, which is meritocracy. I love this, and I'm the same as you. Right? Success is what it's about. And so somebody has success, makes a really good life for themselves, because that's what they should be able to do. But that means that their children then, who have not worked as hard as their parents, have that leg up. And that's always going to be, and then I'm thinking, but why shouldn't they? Because their father or mother worked extremely hard so that they can have that. Yeah. But then the other side of that is, yeah, but they didn't. And I don't know what the answer to that is.
Well, I think the answer to that is that if you're trying to engineer like a perfectly fair reality, you're fucked. Because, you know, we don't live in a perfect world. Yeah. And that is, you know, Nepo stuff, it is unfair. It does go against this kind of Western idea of meritocracy. But it's kind of like an unfixable problem. you know, like what are you going to do? Have a rule where nobody is allowed to inherit anything from their parents anymore? Like that's a much greater unfairness than the unfairness of people being born into privilege. I mean, I'm solidly middle class. I went to a comprehensive school. I didn't go to university. Didn't inherit lots of money. You know, like so you know, I just think, I mean, and I think that's some of the problem with idealism is this relentless attempt at creating this kind of forensically perfect status game. It can't happen, you know. Like if you're looking for perfection, you're never going to find it. You're always going to be disappointed, and you're always going to be angry.
Why? I was going to make a joke there. I just don't know why. Just my mum says that to me. Well, I don't know what. why is Hitler speaking English relevant to understanding the Nazis through the prism of status?
Hitler speaking English?
Yeah.
I don't know anything about Hitler speaking English.
Well, he didn't really speak English, but the AI model.
The AI thing. That was just something Joe Rogan showed me. I don't know why he showed me it.
I know, but he got a lot of views, so I'm asking you about it.
Yeah, and I changed the subject with him, as I will do for you now. One of the things that I wanted to do in the status game was, the argument in the status game is that status is a fundamental human need. It's not like a nice to have. We have to have it psychologically. It's a relentless pursuit by every human. They will find some way of feeling of value. So if that's true, that means we must see the results of this kind of status play everywhere in our personal lives, but also in the grand sweep of history. And so I devoted a chapter to the Nazis, and I devoted a chapter at the end to communism, because I think communism is really interesting way of looking at this too. And what was fascinating about looking at the rise of the Nazis for me was that when I was sort of being brought up, it was very much this story of, Hitler was a monster, and he got power, and he kind of hypnotized all these Germans into being racists. And that's the story of the Nazis. And it doesn't actually make a lot of sense. Like, it doesn't feel like a true story to me.
No.
But that was the kind of folk story that we all believed. Which sort of always begged the question, and you know, every tin pot Nazi documentary you're ever going to see will have a version of this thing of, how could it be that this incredibly impressive, civilized, cultured nation fell to this level of depravity? And what I found when I was researching this through the kind of lens of status was that the fact that they were high culture, civilized, in other words, high status, was the reason that it happened. So it's not like, how could these people do this? It was like, well, they did this because they were up there. And so really, I think what the story is at the turn of the century, the Germans were the most successful nation in continental Europe. They were massively successful technologically. They had the Google and Apple of their day, in companies like Siemens. They were, you know, huge agriculturally. They were, you know, they were just like incredibly impressive. They were scientifically advanced, industrial advanced, rich, amazing. They were quite a narcissistic culture. Like they knew they were good. Hmm. And so then World War One happens, and they have this. They just assume because we're Germany, we're going to like kill it. We're going to ace it. We're going to win World War One. Of course, they didn't. There was this sudden surprise surrender. So that's humiliating. Yeah, so they've gone from high status to low status. And then there's the Treaty of Versailles, which is even which is humiliation upon humiliation upon humiliation. They had to get rid of most of their kind of military. They had to you know, pay billions of dollars in reparations. Their economy went to shit. So it was just they went from up there to right down there. And when you do that to an individual, they'll tend to have a nervous breakdown. They very often become suicidal. Like that's what happens when you go from high status to low status very quickly. It's very likely you could become seriously mentally ill and very likely and very, very possibly suicidal. And so that's what happened on the level of the nation, really. They went mad. Hitler came into power. And what's interesting is that when you look at all those incidents of Hitler madness, you know, there's hundreds of thousands of people in the streets going completely crazy. Those are the times where Hitler was seen to somehow restore the honor and dignity of Germany by, you know, taking back their industrial heartlands that they'd had to give away because they couldn't afford to pay the reparations, for example, or going into what is now Poland without any pushback, for example. And, you know, really the clincher for me was finding out in Ian Kershaw's amazing book that during the 1930s, again, the folklore of Hitler is he's this raving anti-Semite. Of course, he was a raving anti-Semite. Yeah. But when he's doing those speeches, oh, I know what you were getting at now. Yes. When he's doing those speeches where he's going kind of spitting and getting angry, you imagine he's going on about the Jews. But he wasn't going on about the Jews, because that wasn't playing well with the middle classes in the 1930s. Mm. Actually, he was going on about the glorious future of Germany, the Third Reich. I should be careful doing that and talking about that.
Yeah, I'll put that in the thumbnail.
Yeah.
The trailer.
Yeah, so that's the stuff that was playing well. That's the stuff that people wanted to hear. And that's the stuff that was driving people completely insane and making people obsessed with Hitler. Because not only was he saying, I'm going to restore our status, bring us back to the top of the tree and create this glorious thousand-year Third Reich, he was actually starting to do it. The achievements of the Nazi Party through the 1930s are really quite extraordinary. I mean, I think that they went from about a third of the population being unemployed to full employment by the end of the '30s. It might even be more successful than that. I mean, I know lots of people working in the armaments industry preparing for war, but still, like, yeah. Again, what matters is the perception. That the perception was that he was really restoring Germany's place in the world. So status really explains to me the rise of Hitler. It really explains to me the rise, the popularity of Hitler and the Nazi Party, because not only did he say he was going to restore Hitler's glory, he was actually doing it. Unlike Donald Trump, who says these things, but he's actually a very effective politician.
Right.
This episode is brought to you by Experian. Are you paying for subscriptions you don't use, but can't find the time or energy to cancel them? Experian could cancel unwanted subscriptions for you, saving you an average of $270 per year and plenty of time. Download the Experian app. Results will vary. Not all subscriptions are eligible. Savings are not guaranteed. Paid membership with connected payment account required.
Ah, yes, the magnificent Trolley Sour Bright Crawler, also known as Trollicus brightolus. The worm's captivating neon color makes it an easy, gummy prey.
Trolley!
It's a surprisingly sour, invitingly chewy, staggeringly snackable species unlike anything else found on this planet.
Eat me!
Delicious. Visit trolley.com to shop now.
Trolley, eat me!
Start your electric journey right here, right now. With a Volvo XC90 Recharge, our plug-in hybrid SUV with extended range. For more everyday electric journeys on a single charge, with a hybrid option for longer adventures, Contact your local retailer to book a test drive or design your own vehicle at volvocars.com/US. The Volvo XC90 Recharge Plug-in Hybrid. The electric car with a backup plan.
The Stasi did that as well. I got full, everyone had to, because everyone had, you had to have a job.
Yeah, well, that's communism, isn't it? Everyone has a job, even if there's no actual work to do. They give you a job in inverted commas and give you the pay.
Someone else comes in, you know, more sort of centrist government comes in and got to get rid of all these state work. You know, how do we get them off the bills here? Because they're just, what's happening in Argentina at the moment with Milei, who's a nutcase, goes around with a chainsaw. I don't know if you've seen much about him. I lived a long time in Argentina, so I've sort of got family there.
Wow.
And he's got a chainsaw, like an actual chainsaw, and he runs around, he's going to rip up. Because they've been too lefty for quite long, Argentina.
Have they?
And they've got too many people sort of just, you know, eating from the, I was going to say sucking off the state. So it's the state or something.
Yeah,
what do you say?
It's a funny image that, yeah.
Yeah, what do you say? What's the metaphor there?
Leeching off the state.
Leeching off the state.
Yeah.
I don't know if we'll include my first. but it's funny just being in Berlin, though. I lived in Berlin for a few years after that, and they've got this thing called Ostalgie. You know, the East and nostalgia.
Nostalgia for the old East,
Loads of them love it because it was a fully employed time. Mm-hmm. Women had better benefits and things like that, but they had no individual freedom. So
yeah, and the economy couldn't cope with this idea of full employment. I did some reporting for GQ about a long time ago now, about 15 years ago, when all the Polish people were coming to England. And so they sent me to Poland to find out why they were coming to England. And I had a fixer, a local journalist, and I said to her, you know, it's amazing how hardworking, you know, it was so hardworking the Polish people are. She was like, it's funny you say they were hardworking. The Poles are not hardworking. We are very lazy people. She said, we have a post-Soviet mindset. And I said, what does that mean, a post-Soviet mindset? And she said, well, you know, in the Soviet Union, everybody would have a job. So, but there would and it would be guaranteed work. So you turn up to work and just drink vodka all day and get drunk. And then what would happen is if a young ambitious person came in and started working really hard, they made everyone else look really bad. So they'd get bullied effectively until they started behaving and just started drinking vodka instead. So and she said there was a phrase we used to have where you can turn up for work, or you can stand up or you can lie down, it doesn't matter, you're still going to get paid. I mean, I think it's lost its elegance in translation, but you get the sense of it where it doesn't matter, you know. So I think that's one of the reasons communism failed, or the main reason communism failed, is because it worked against human nature. And human nature is a lot of it's about communion and connection, and that's the stuff the communists had right, you know, like all us all coming together and doing this thing together. That's a great human thing. But we also want to be recognized as individuals. We also want individual value and individual status. And that's why communism can never work, because it runs against human nature itself. You have to allow people to play their own status games, to earn to feel individually valuable in the world. You know, we all want that. And it's good that we do want that, because that's the engine of civilization. That's the engine of progress.
Yeah, I think so too. And I also liked your Polish accent, which was sort of mid-Atlantic, English-American. I believe we'll fight them on the beaches. So
I've only got one accent. And you've just
I thought it was quite good. Yeah, and I'm ashamed you abandoned it halfway through, because I was enjoying it. It's the one thing I wish I could do better is accents.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is. I just would love to be able to just when people do it, I'm mesmerized. I will sit and watch someone do all the accents.
Yeah.
It's a nice thing, isn't it? Mm. On an individual level, I saw you talking on Stephen Bartlett about the myth that anyone can do what they want and be whoever they are. What's that about?
Yeah, so in my book Selfie, I wrote about this, about...
Sorry. five months.
This off. Myth we have in the West. You know, like I'm a great defender of the West and you know, Western individualism, but there are also downsides to it. And one of the big downsides to it is that we tell ourselves a bit of a lie, and that lie is that you, the individual, can do anything you want to do. Mm. You know, it's a very ancient Greek idea, the individual hero coming up fighting monsters and bringing back prizes to the community. You know, it's a very motivating myth. You can see why people want to believe it, because it's optimistic, it's promising status. But it's not true, and it's not true because of genes. I mean, you know, we're all limited in certain ways because of our genotype. That's just a fact. You know, it's not that genes are you know, we're not completely fated by our genes, but they set certain limits upon us. there's no way I could ever dance like Beyonce. Hmm. I mean, no, they're just, or even sing like Beyonce, no matter how much I wanted to. So I think that's the problem with a lot of Western thought, and you see it coming up a lot in the self-help world, the wellness world. This idea that you can do whatever you want to do, you just got to dream big enough. The dark side of that is that when we fail, when most of the time we fail, because most of human life is unfortunately failure, we blame ourselves. Like if my success is down to me and me alone, then my failure is too. So it's a kind of quite a savage ideology, that idea that you can do anything you want to do.
We blame others as well.
Yeah.
I think that is that part. And also I'm seeing a lot with, I've got a sister who's 17. So all the kids at school, and I suppose it's related to status as well. Everyone seems to have a thing, whether it is dyslexia or dyspraxia or autism or gender dysphoria.
Yeah.
I don't think she has one single friend who doesn't have at least one of those things. Is that seems to be a status thing, and also a sort of reason why they may not be succeeding, because everybody's expected to succeed so much.
Yeah, it's a strange phenomenon that's relatively recent. All these labels, these neurodivergent things. Mm. Yeah, I know people close to me that are a bit like that too, and it's strange. I mean, I believe it's status. It seems to be about status. It's part of identity. You know, like it's a claim from identity. It almost feels like people wear it like jewelry. Like I've got ADHD, I've got anxiety, I've got autism. The three A's tend to go together quite a lot for some reason. I think it's a lot of it is about, again, we all want to feel like we have individual value and that we are interesting and unique. And I think this is a kind of wrong-headed often way of claiming that kind of unique status. Well, I've got all these interesting quirks and, you know, flaws, and that makes me
perfect.
Yeah.
Well, I've got excuses for not succeed. I mean, that I get frustrated sometimes because it seems to imply to me then, because I don't have any of those things, that like writing a book is just easy, you know, just da-ba-da-ba-da-da-da.
Yes.
Whereas actually I'm sitting there going, this is terrible. I don't know what I'm doing.
Oh, yeah.
I wasn't good at English and stuff at school. You know, I wasn't good at a lot of these things. So that's what why, and people say, oh, sorry, I wasn't concentrating. I've got this thing. And it's an excuse because it's like, well, it's not easy for me to concentrate either.
Yeah, well, exactly. I think there is a lot of that. It's a good handy excuse for, can be a handy excuse for not achieving that competence-based status that people tend to want to get. Yeah.
In terms of advice for people watching, is it better... I was going to ask you, you know, how can people achieve status? You know, what's an easy way to sort of climb up the status? Or is it better for them to go to learn to be okay with not having so much status?
No, because again, I think it's important not to think that status is about being the best, because it's not about being the best. It's about being quite good at something. Like, you know, it's like the goal. And if you're super ambitious, the goal is going to be up there. But that's if it's not you, it's not you. It doesn't, and that's a good thing that it's not you, because it means that you're going to be happy.
Yeah,
being just. But better than average, and so it's perfectly possible, and in fact much more ordinary, for somebody to go into work every day and to be treated with respect and dignity by their employees, and to feel like, oh, I've performed quite well at work today, and that's enough. You know, it doesn't have to be about work. It can be about being a great Christian, or being a great Muslim, or it can be about being a great football player, or not even great, just being good. Like I scored a goal. I was, you know, like, or whatever those football players do. So I think that the advice is, like, one of the most important things is to realize that you're not playing status games against everybody in the whole world. The world is made up of infinite different status games, and you get to choose which ones you play. You know, you don't have to be a footballer if you don't want to be a footballer. There are other perfectly legitimate ways to earn status. The other thing is again, you don't have to be the best. It's not about being the best. It's about feeling like you're quite good at something. And the other thing is it's really about, I think, finding your niche, especially if you're a younger person. Figure out what you enjoy doing. You know, follow your joy. what is it that that you get into those kind of amazing flow states with? Like, do that. And I think the good news is that do that for a living, even if it's never going to make you wealthy. Like, I think in the West, we mistake money for status. Like, money is one way you can measure your status, but most of us don't measure it that way, really. You know, you don't have to be rich to be happy. Like, it sounds banal and stupid to say, but you really don't. You just have to feel like I'm offering value to other people. And that can be being a nurse or a teacher or whatever it is that that brings you joy. Do that, you know. So I think that's the good news. This kind of idea that we have in the West that we have to be wealthy or famous or to be happy or to feel successful is completely wrong.
I've seen so many people start off in doing things like finance when they're like 21.
Yeah.
And by the time they're 29, 30, they want to like teach kids.
Yes.
They want to help because you need that in your life.
Yeah.
I've got one more question for you, but first tell us where, because you've done so much, where do you want to send people to?
Oh, online?
Well, it could be online or yeah. What books to get.
Okay, well, what books to get? My latest book is The Status Game, which we've been talking about.
One of my favorite ever books.
Thank you. Yeah. And the my website is willstor.com, willstor.com. Yeah, willstor.com.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. People should, honestly, it is one of my favorite books ever. So yeah. I hope people do go and get it. And your other books are as well. So Selfie and Heretics. The Heretics?
The Heretics.
The Heretics. Yeah, yeah. I love those as well.
Thank you.
Who's a heretic you admire?
Oh my God. Who's a heretic that I admire? That's a good question.
Myself aside.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Oh my God. Who's a heretic that I admire?
We can pause it for a minute and like.
Yeah, do because like there'll be loads. I like.
I'll just cough for a minute.
Yes. who's a
heretic? Everyone just says Christopher Hitchens.
Oh, he wasn't really a heretic. But that's the thing, isn't it? Like Christopher Hitchens. Like he was a great polemicist.
Yeah.
But he wasn't. Like being a heretic is a kind of a local thing, isn't it? Like,
are we including this bit? Is this,
yeah, because okay. to his own people, he was a hero. He didn't never really suffered for being a heretic.
Like the moment he moved over, though, because he was a big lefty, and there was a moment, it was 9/11,
yeah,
where he didn't like how a lot of his comrades, he used to call them, spoke about, sort of criticized the West.
Yeah.
And that's when he sort of came out with a lot of stuff. And he, you know, and he put himself on the firing line just after Salman Rushdie had gotten the Ayatollah thing, the fatwa. So that's an argument for some sort of cost to him.
Well, for me, yeah, it would be a cost. So any Israeli, Jewish Israeli that is critical of how the Israelis treat the Palestinians has my respect, because that's a brave thing to do. And there's lots of Jewish Israelis who are critical of what's going on in that part of the world at the moment. For me personally, people I've met, like I've talked about him before, but there's a guy called Mark Linus who I really respect. He's a heretic who I wrote about in The Guardian. I wrote an article about him in The Guardian. I also wrote about him briefly in The Science of Storytelling. And I admire him hugely because he did do that thing of changing his mind and sacrificing everything. He was one of the original eco-terrorists.
Right.
Yes. So he'd be one of these people that go into the crop field, GM crops, and destroy them all. And he was partly responsible for the rise in anti-Monsanto stuff that was going on 10, 15 years ago. So he wrote a book about climate change. He said, and in order to sort of fill his book, he realized he had to find out about some science, figure out how science worked. So he did that, and he filled his climate change book with science. I was like, great, that was a success. And he kind of fell in love with science. His next book was about GM foods, genetically modified foods. So he did the same thing again, and he looked at the science, and he realized that the science says that there's actually nothing wrong with GM food, that there's billions of GM meals been served, and no one's ever been sick from any of them. Right. And what's more, I think the product is called golden rice. There's this GM version of rice with added vitamins which could save the lives of, I don't know whether it's hundreds of thousands or millions of children in India. But because Greenpeace are ideologically against GM foods, that there's a huge lobby against it. So he did the brave thing of saying, I've got this book deal attacking GM foods. I've been this eco-terrorist against GM foods, but I've checked the science. I've looked at the science. I've understood the science. Not only is it is it say it's fine. Actually, we're the ones doing damage in the world by preventing all these potentially very beneficial products coming out. And he lost everything. He lost all of his friends. He was excommunicated. So I told his story in the Guardian. You can find that online. So he's a heretic that I admire because he didn't do that cowardly thing that we were talking about at the beginning of the chat of just going, oh, I just better keep my mouth shut about this. He actually went out there, and I think he actually stood up at a farmers conference and apologized to the farmers in Oxford at this Gatford conference and said, you know, like, I'm sorry, I've been wrong about all this stuff, and I've caused a lot of damage.
You can't keep the same friends then. You have to sort of be a bit love bombed by the new side, and then you get into that side.
Well, yeah. I know he was very great friends with George Monbiot, the writer. And
yeah, I've interviewed him.
Yeah, George Monbiot, I think, you know, like, cut him off, which upset him a lot.
George has some, because he's always talking about the eco stuff, which is, you know, okay if you're interested.
Yeah.
But being someone who is interested in the kind of like books that you write and stuff like that, he's got some phenomenal stories of just like running away from a like tropical bee. there's a story, and it's on an old episode I did, and it's because that's all I really wanted to talk about. And he was talking about the environment, this and that, and I'm sort of thinking that, yeah, but I'll be fine. And then as long as I'm all right and my kids are all right, just about everything, I don't really care. Grandkids until I'm dead, and then after that, I don't care. I'm not actually that horrible. I'm just, I am a bit, but he was, yeah, he had this bee got him, it stung him, and he was dying, and he had to crawl into like a high up hut from a ladder somewhere and try to like explain what was happening to just, and he's got a few stories like that. Just phenomenal.
Yeah. Well, I've met him and he's a lovely man. And also he very kindly, when the Heretics was published in America, they didn't want to call it the Heretics because they said it was too much, had religious connotations. And Monbiot had written a great column called The Unpersuadables. And I said, can I please steal your title for my book? And he very kindly let me call my book The Unpersuadables in America. So I've got nothing against George. I think he's been very kind to me.
Well, there you go. And you've been very kind to me. So I was just because you put the new John Ronson on my book, which is going to get it loads of sales. And you know that. And it's a very nice thing to do. Thank you, Will Storr. What a pleasure it was to speak to one of my literary heroes. I really, really enjoyed that. And he was a lot of fun to talk to before and after as well. Guys, please do go out and get The Status Game or any of Will's brilliant books. I just absolutely love his writing. I think it's really, really good, really well researched, and just one of my favorite writers. So get The Status Game. Make sure you also get The Psychology of Secrets. That's my book, of course. And I hope you'll enjoy that as well. It's written in the same vein. Will's name is on the front, and I think the back as well. Says some nice things, which is really, really nice of him. And I will see you next time.